This is Fresh Air. It's very difficult to make sense of today's international news. Fighting in the former Yugoslavia, armed bandits preventing food shipments in Somalia, neo-Nazi attacks in Germany, chaos in the former Soviet Union, uncertainty all over the Middle East. In each region where there is conflict, there's a different history and a different set of grievances behind the fighting. My guest is Fred Halliday, a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics and a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. We asked Halliday to help us make sense of the post-Cold War world.
The world is in chaos, and in that sense, talk about a new world order, whether by supporters of it or critics of it, is nonsense. We've got a new world disorder. But I don't think we should be too pessimistic, because in certain ways the world is still a better place than it was 5 years ago. First of all, the threat of nuclear war, which would have annihilated not just the present generations, but the future of mankind, has very significantly receded. Even if there is some greater amount of nuclear proliferation, it's not going to lead to a world conflagration. Secondly, the domination of the world by military conflict, i.e. war, or the threat of war in arms races or whatever, between great powers, which has dominated the war really since the last century, since the 1890s, when it began in Europe with Britain and Germany and France, and then in the Far East between Japan and Russia and China, that domination has ended. So we're now in a world where whatever else, and I think for a generation, a long generation, 30 years, the prospect of military conflict or serious preparation for military conflict between great powers has receded, and I repeat, for the first time for a century. Thirdly, there is a greater awareness in the world today, I think, of the interdependence of issues. In other words, that the world economy is one, and that even if you can have prosperity in some areas and not in others, you're not going to stop the populations from the poorer areas trying to move, whether it's from Mexico or from Russia into Western Europe. And also that the ecological issues which we face in many different dimensions are ones which are global. So these three things, I think, the retreat of the danger of worldwide nuclear war, the end of major military rivalry between great powers, and thirdly, some qualified but some greater awareness of interdependent issues, I think are positive. Now, having said that, clearly things are going very wrong. First of all, we live in a world where there is only one answer, capitalism, but capitalism hasn't solved the problem either of underdevelopment or the problem of world economic recession, and we're on the edge of major new problems in developed countries as well as in the third world. And secondly, you have this explosion of ethnic conflict and of very ferocious and short-sighted nationalism. Now, in one sense, nothing new about this. I mean, anybody who's studied the Arab-Israeli question or the Irish question will be eminently familiar at 5 minutes reading with what's happening in Yugoslavia or the Caucasus or Tajikistan or Punjab or whatever. All these nationalisms claim to be unique and individual. Actually, they're all the same in many ways, including their refusal to compromise and their fake invocation of history. But that isn't something which began with the end of the Cold War. It's something which we've seen developing in its current form over the last 20 years. After all, the Irish question exploded in the late 60s, the Basque question at the same time. The Punjab has been smoldering for 15 years. But with the end of communist control in Eastern Europe and in the former Soviet Union, and I would argue in Afghanistan, you are seeing these forces gaining ground in a very dangerous way. And tied to that is another process, which is the disintegration or weakening of states. Now, we all know states are oppressive, states are exploitative, they're parasitic, but if you don't have a state, you can be worse off, as is the case in Somalia, or as the case in Lebanon, or the case in Chad.
You know, I have this frustration, which I'm sure a lot of people feel. You pick up the newspaper and you're trying to make sense of what's happening around the world, and there are so many regional conflicts involved with historical disputes and ethnic identity and so on, that it's really hard to comprehend the specifics of the fighting in the different regions. And I think a lot of people are almost giving up in frustration.
Well, I don't think people ever did understand them. They thought they did for two reasons, one or two reasons. One was they put them into a Cold War framework and said, well, let's look at the conflict in the Horn of Africa. The Eritreans, the communists, so the Ethiopians must be good, or vice versa. And the Arab-Israeli question, well, the Arabs get arms from Moscow, so the Israelis must be good. Or in 1948, 49, don't forget, Israelis get support from Stalin, therefore the Arabs must be good, which a lot of people in the West thought. And so on and so on. In other words, they put these things into a Cold War framework, which never was apposite, but satisfied that intellectual curiosity that you mentioned. At least people thought they knew where to pigeonhole them, even if they actually didn't. Second thing is that most people until recently focused on one issue or the other. I mean, people from Ireland focused on the Irish question. People with Jewish background or people from the Arab side of the Middle East focused on the Arab-Israeli question. They didn't look at these things comparatively, whereas now you have to say there are all these things going on. And clearly, to bone up on the latest developments in Chechnya, Ingushetia, in the Northern Caucasus, or what's happening in the Khojent region of Tajikistan, or in the Moro region of the Philippines, or the question of the expulsion of Muslims from Burma, requires a bit of work, and there's not much you can do about it. But I think beyond that, there is a reluctance to see that deep down these things have similar roots. They have socioeconomic roots, the lack of jobs, lack of states which can provide security and economic development to these people, and also a failure of political leadership, because throughout the post-communist world, but also in the post-colonial third world, people fall back on simplistic nationalist explanations. I mean, take the question of Croatia, Serbia, Bosnia. You listen to Croatians speaking fluent English, who've lived in Britain for 20 years, saying what's wrong with Croatia is the Ottomans brought the Serb settlers who came here in the 16th century, or the 15th century. Now, wait a minute. This is a fake invocation of history to settle what are present disputes about land, about employment, to some extent about religion as well. And I think it's that repeated pattern of the misuse of the past. The past didn't cause these problems. It's the present which caused these problems. People don't go out and kill each other because something that happened 100 years ago. They do it because of something now, like they think they could grab someone's land or someone's house, or in some case someone's women, or whatever it is. They'll go out and they'll kill for present reasons. And the past is the pretext. It's not the cause. And I think if you look at them comparatively, similar factors emerge. I'm not saying they're all the same, but I think very similar factors underlie all of these, with the deceptive fact that in each one everybody says that we're unique.
I'm wondering...
I think that the outside world has been much too indulgent of all this nonsense. We need what I would call an epoch of benign intolerance. That is, the outside states putting their foot down and saying, enough of all these. These things are not going to run their course. Look at Ireland. It hasn't run its course in 20 years.
My guest is Fred Halliday, Professor of International Relations at the London School of Economics. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is professor and journalist Fred Halliday. He's written extensively about the Middle East and the Soviet Union. Is this period of international affairs making you any more pessimistic than you were before? Because now a lot of the fighting is no longer about ideology. It's about ethnicity or religion or other regional disputes. But, I mean, the fighting isn't stopping, even though some of the ideological battles like communism versus capitalism have ended.
Well, I am pessimistic, but I'm pessimistic for a reason which, even in my political generation, that's people who came to politics in the 1960s, has been clear for some time. And I would go to the two inter-ethnic conflicts that I know best, the Arab-Israeli question, which I've studied and talked to people from since the 1967 war, the Six-Day War between Israel and the Arab states, and the conflict at which I grew up, namely the conflict between Protestants and Catholics in Ireland. And without denying the differences between them, and there are many, and the dangers of false comparison are also many, I do think there is one underlying and pessimistic lesson, and that is a lesson which does depress me as I look around the world, and that is that people don't learn from their mistakes. People think once they get into the dynamic of inter-ethnic conflict, they think one last push and we'll make it, or the other people will come to their senses, or if we have another progressive atrocity, we'll be able to frighten the other side. And we have bombs going off in London virtually every night now, organised by the IRA, who believe that one more progressive atrocity in London and the British will change their mind. They're not going to. In other words, it's not just that people don't want to compromise, but there is a dynamic of conflict there which doesn't need majority support on either side. The paramilitary in Ireland, on the Protestant or the Catholic side in Northern Ireland, don't have the majority support of either community. They have indulgence of a significant minority. They're very small recruitment, but you can keep such a thing going. And that's on the basis of relatively slight historical injustices compared to what you have, say, in Yugoslavia or in the Caucasus or in Tajikistan or in Punjab, and I could go on. In other words, it's once that dynamic is up and running, it's very hard to stop. And there are always politicians around who will seek to abuse it, as there are on both sides of the communal divide in Ireland and there are in the Arab-Israeli conflict and so on.
You said that you think in this period of ethnic intolerance and belligerence that there should be more, what was the expression you used?
Benign impatience.
Benign impatience, yeah, from other parts of the world, from other powers. What do you mean by that? And what's an example of how you think that could be done?
Well, I'll give you two examples. In the case of Yugoslavia, we've had now a war situation for close on a year. There's been a lot of hand-wringing, international conferences, ministerial visits to try and stop the Serbian war of aggression, first against Croatia and then against Bosnia. Perhaps 1.5 million people are now refugees in the rather cold winter of the Balkans, and tens of thousands of people have been killed. Had the international community acted quicker, been more impatient in the interests of stopping this process, in the interests of Croatia, Bosnia, and in my view, the interests of the Serbs, who have a place in the future of all this, the disaster would have been much less. Similarly, in the case of Somalia, the situation has been allowed to go for month after month after month after month, partly, frankly, because of the US elections, and nobody, Bush nor Clinton, wanted to risk anything by saying that anything should be done. So I think there's been too much saying, well, we must let these things run their course, or we must listen to both sides. People say, look, A, the international community is not willing to pay the price of these things going on for years, because the price will be even greater in terms of refugees, aid, arms flows, and so on. And secondly, there has been too much acceptance of the right of all these parties to do whatever they want. Now, you can call it intervention, you can call it imperialism, you can call it something in between. But frankly, that's better than just allowing all these things to run their course.
I wonder what you made of the focus on domestic affairs in the recent American elections.
Well, I visit the States a lot and have been doing so since the early 70s and have a lot of working relations with people in the States. I don't minimize for a minute the internal problems the United States has, but I do think there is a note of self-indulgence and exaggeration with regard to the whole issue of American decline. There are many problems the Americans haven't solved, and some of them, they're way behind other countries, such as controlling personal access to weapons or raising income tax and gasoline taxes to the normal levels of other developed countries. But having said all that, it still is a very rich country with immense political and economic potential, often abused, particularly in the last decade or two vis-a-vis the Third World. And the issue of American decline in overall terms is greatly overstated by Americans of the left and of the right. So it's quite proper that after the end of the Cold War and with all the internal issues in the United States, people should say, let's sort out our domestic questions. But there is a tinge of irresponsibility and a tinge, frankly, of self-indulgence in all this. I mean, you know, if you think that America is such an awful country, and you should try some of the problems of some of the other countries we have in the world, and developed countries, including this one. And that side of things, while preferable to jingoism and militarism of the kind that Bush might have espoused, A, is an inaccurate picture of where America stands in the world vis-a-vis other countries, and secondly, is one that leads to a turning away from what are, in my view, America's international responsibilities. Now, those responsibilities have been irresponsibly and violently used in the past, as in the war in Vietnam, as in the invasion of Panama. But in other respects, I think they have to be assumed, and the choice is not between America, as we're turning in on itself, or shouldn't be between America turning in itself or being an imperialist country, but between America playing a more or less positive international role.
My guest is professor and journalist Fred Halliday. We'll talk about the Middle East peace talks in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fred Halliday, professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. He's written extensively about the Soviet Union and the Middle East. America helped initiate the Middle East peace talks, which resume next week. They seem to be in a kind of stalemate. The last round ended early, not because so much had been accomplished, but because so little had been accomplished in that round. What are your hopes for them at the moment?
Well, I remain hopeful that these talks can yield something, but I admit, as anybody who knows much about this conflict must admit, that they could well end in failure. And there isn't infinite time. I wouldn't have thought there was more than a year or 18 months, partly because the Palestinians, delegates and those among the Palestinian community who support negotiation will have to be given something if they're not going to be overtaken and overwhelmed by a very strong hostility built up over many years within their own community to deals with Israel that must involve giving up most of what Palestinians have wanted to see. After all, the most the Palestinians are going to get out of this, the most, is a very circumscribed state in 10 years at the least, in 15 or 18% of what most Palestinians regard as their territory. Now, if they're not even going to get that, or the prospect of that, the Hanan Ashrawis and the Faisal Husseinis and even the Yasser Arafats of this world will be in the dustbin, or worse, and much more radical people will take over. On the Israeli side, the Labour Party people say, and they're probably right, that Likud was badly defeated in the last election, but with growing economic problems and stalemate in the talks, they may well gain ground. And so they've only got 18 months or a year as well. So I think something has to break in all this.
Do you see the Middle East peace talks as an example of what you were talking about earlier, everybody holding out for more than they could possibly get and thinking just, well, one more stab at it and I know we'll get it, one more bomb attack or one more whatever and I know we'll get what we want?
Well, there are a lot of people on both sides who think that. There are a lot of Israelis who think, well, if we tough it out, the Palestinians will go away, they're only just refugees, and so on and so forth. And there are very significant numbers of Palestinians, particularly young people, who think, what are we doing negotiating with someone which has stolen 80% or all of our land, driven half of our people into refugee camps, bombed us, strafed us, tortured us, and so forth. So there's a lot of bitterness there. It has to be said that, if anything, these talks go against my argument, because at least after 40 years, but I say at least, with enormous human suffering and waste of resources, we are now at a position where some compromise may be possible. For the most selfish of reasons, to do with oil and the U.S. economy, the U.S. government has got involved and tried to broker a solution and should be encouraged in that. And that is what the Palestinians want. If you read what Arafat made a big speech only a couple of days ago, he's saying, you know, will the Americans get on and speak to the Israelis and put pressure on them? Nelson Mandela is saying the same thing from South Africa. So it's an example of people appealing to the U.S. to do something rather than to do nothing, whether or not they're imperialist.
Are you confident that the Arab countries are willing on any level to grant Israel's right to exist?
I've spent quite a lot of time in the Arab world since 1967, and I would say in the 70s and late 60s, very few people were willing to grant Israel's right to exist and were willing to talk about Israel as if it was another country. In fact, they very often found it very hard even to mention the name of the country. There's been a significant shift there. Not an absolute one. There are people in the Arab world and elsewhere who don't want Israel to exist. But there are a significant number of people in government and among populations who are willing to accept a compromise peace, a just peace. First person who did that, to his credit, although few people gave him credit at the time, was Anwar Sadat in 1977, who went to Jerusalem. He squandered his opportunity, but he did break the ice. The Jordanians, I have no doubt, King Hussein or his successors, if he passes on, are committed to living with Israel. The PLO in late 1988, far too late in my view, 40 years too late indeed, nevertheless accepted a binational solution, and they're sticking to it. And any settlement will have to be made to stick by international guarantees on both sides, to restrain the Israelis and the Arabs. So there'll be continuing international involvement. But I do think there is sufficient political will there, and this has been made all the stronger by the Gulf War, because in the Gulf itself, in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and elsewhere, they're no longer worried about being attacked by Israel, which was always their fantasy in the past. They're worried about being attacked either by Saddam or by the Iranians. And under right conditions, they're not only willing to have diplomatic relations with Israel, they're willing to do business with Israel. Some of them are already through indirect means. And that, I think, is another reason why the climate has changed. And if you just read the Arabic press, or look at Arabic television or radio, and even look at the willingness of Arab television stations now to interview Israeli officials who speak Arabic directly without a lot of nonsense and circumspection, this is an important breakthrough. So yes, there are people who don't want Israel to exist, but there has been a shift. And in terms of a feeling, a gut feeling, I would have said 10, 15 years ago, no. And now I would say yes, but it will involve guarantees.
You live in London. Which of the conflicts around the world now are hitting closest to home for you?
Well, if you live in London, the conflict that's hitting closest to home is the Irish question, because of the bombing campaign which the IRA is waging in the pre-Christmas period here, and which means that virtually every day parts of the city are closed off or underground stations are closed. Mercifully, few people have been killed so far, but I think that has not always been the case in the past and will not be again any more than it has been in Northern Ireland. Secondly, the Bosnian question, the issue of Bosnian refugees. After all, it's 2 hours' flight to Sarajevo from here. People go all the time, people go in buses, people are taking food and clothing, and people are bringing back refugees and trying to bring them into the country. And there's no easy solution to that question in terms of what policy should be or whether to try and look after them there or whatever. And of course, British troops are also involved. Then thirdly, there's the war in Somalia. After all, part of Somalia, the northern part, Somaliland, as it's now called, is a former British colony. There used to be, I would think, 500, maybe 1,000, maybe 2,000 Somalis living in this country. Now there are 20, 30, 40,000. They've been allowed in large numbers. Their conditions are terrible, as have people from other parts of Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa in general, and the Sudan. So that, because of the colonial link, that Horn of Africa issue is very, very present. Those three are particularly present here.
Well, Fred Halliday, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Fred Halliday is a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics and a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. He spoke with us from the NPR Bureau in London.